Hi, this is Gareth Coker, and you are listening to the Sound Architect Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Sound Architect Podcast. I am once again joined today by the lovely composer, Gareth Coker. Thanks for joining me again today, Gareth. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Sam. How about yourself?
Pretty good as well. And I have to say, it's a really big pleasure to have you back on the show. I think it's the third time now that we've had you on the podcast.
You can't get rid of me anymore, but it's basically because I've been probably doing too much work the last 2 or 3 years, something like that.
This is one of my first questions, but before we get there, the last time we spoke was, I believe, last year or just before, and we were discussing Ori and the Will of the Wisps. And as you just said, you've been rather busy since then, haven't you? You've got a lot on your plate.
It's funny because it's one of those things, it looks like I've been busy, but it's one of those things where the releases kind of just fell at a really good time. They sometimes tend to all drop at once, and then something gets lost, but these have kind of like been evenly spaced out. So the actual work comes and goes. It's not like I've been constantly working. There was periods where it gets tricky when some things overlap, but it gives off the illusion of being busy, at least, because I've had these releases like constantly dropping like every 6 months or so.
So I'm assuming the work actually done on them then was quite staggered over the last year or so.
Yeah, there are a few spots where things got tricky, and really in terms of scheduling, once the pandemic got into full flow,
yeah,
the scheduling went out of the window, not just for me, but for pretty much every single entertainment company on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
So so that obviously required some recalibration. But in many respects, I've found that pretty much everyone who I've worked with has kind of understood that, because I think there's just been adjustment across the spectrum for everyone.
Yeah.
As you are probably aware yourself.
Yes, the last nearly 2 years have been very different, shall we say.
Right. Well, didn't you have to ship one of the control expansions during the pandemic, or am I getting my timeline?
No, that's correct. Yeah, we delivered the AWE DLC for Control during the pandemic.
That's right. Which I just finished like 2 or 3 months ago.
Oh, fantastic.
I finally wrapped up the Control DLC because the Series X upgrade came out with ray tracing. I was like, yeah, I'm going to revisit Control.
It's pretty awesome with ray tracing on, I have to say.
But that's a game because of its general look. It definitely benefited in a big way from the lighting upgrade. So congrats on that.
Thank you. I wanted to talk to you about Immortals Fenyx Rising, even way back when, to be honest, because although I've not played it, I adore mythology in all its forms. So it seems right up my street. But how did you first hear about or get involved with that project?
I got a message from my agent, said, would I be interested in working with Ubisoft in a potential title? Because when you hear it's Ubisoft, you're like, could this be? It's probably going to be a pretty big title because Ubisoft only seems to do really big titles that are massive and sprawling.
Yeah.
I found out that they'd tempt what they've been working on so far with my Minecraft Greek mythology soundtrack and Ori. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm probably in a pretty good spot to get this gig. I did a little pitch for it, which I think they flew me out to Quebec. This is back in May 2019.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I went to, play and check out the game. And I was like, this is really fresh and different. What's interesting about mythology is the word mythology gives you so much creative and cinematic license, because it can mean one thing to one person, another thing to another. You only have to look at the Greek mythology games that have come out recently. Hades is one of them, has its own distinct style. God of War is another one, has its own distinct style. And Immortals Fenyx Rising has its own distinct style. And I think the thing that struck me about it first was how it looked, the colors and the animation style, and then the tone of the game, which is very lighthearted. I like to compare it to DreamWorks animation, not a Pixar animation, a DreamWorks animation. I feel like DreamWorks animations have a very strict like, sorry, not strict. They strictly stick to a certain tone, which is a little bit more lighthearted than some of their competitors. And it's kind of meant that they've forged their own niche. And that's kind of what I felt like when I was looking at the game. And if you just look at some gameplay of the game, it is not taking itself seriously. Where in Greek mythology and some of the Greek mythology stories are very serious, it's a lighthearted take on Greek mythology. And for example, just when you're in combat, you kill an enemy and it goes flying like 100 feet into the distance. It's completely not based on any real physics whatsoever. It is based on, you know, let's give the player maximum enjoyment and fun. And by giving them maximum enjoyment and fun, they'll want to keep immersing themselves in this fictional world that we've created. It's really a fictional playground for them to tell stories of different Greek gods. And I looked at this and I was like, this is a great opportunity to, you know, kind of stretch my legs musically. And the style we ended up going for, we didn't want to do a super serious Greek mythology soundtrack because that's kind of already been done.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to go too contemporary either. So we kind of found this really nice hybrid between big epic orchestral stuff for like the big moments in the game. And then a lot of the more intimate stuff, including a lot of the exploration music. Sorry, a lot of the exploration music is quite intimate and personal because each area of the island is associated with a different god. The gameplay takes place on an island. Typhon, the main antagonist of the game, has imprisoned six different gods on six different parts of the island, and they're kind of all themed appropriately. So Aphrodite's area is more lush and beautiful because she's the goddess of beauty. Then Hephaestus's area is themed like a forge because Hephaestus was the god of the forge. So they have all of these six distinct areas, and that kind of lends itself to having a unique musical style for each area. So when you're playing through the game, let's just take Aphrodite's region as an example. You have the exploration music, which is fairly light, and that kind of gets the idea is to get you into the thematic style of the god. So if I was like, I'm going to write whatever I think Aphrodite's music sounds like and just associate that with being as beautiful as possible. So Aphrodite's core music has a lot of female vocals and it's quite light and airy. And then Hephaestus's explore music is, there's a lot of metallic elements in the music and it's a little bit more percussive. And then as you progress through each region, when you get to the boss fight music or the heavier combat music, then we can dial in the orchestra there. So what it means is that the orchestra isn't overused, which is a classic problem that I think a lot of composers might be running into with these large scale games. It's like you have the option to have an orchestra, but it's like, if you use it too much, it can actually end up diminishing its impact unless you write for the orchestra really, really sensibly and reduce the number of instruments playing. The temptation could be to have, when you have like a big orchestra, is to like, let's use all the players all the time.
Yeah.
That's actually not always the best solution. So from one region, when you start in one region and until completing it, you're going to get the full dynamic range of music. The lightest being when you're in flight in a region, that is like the lightest sound track you will have while playing the game. Usually when you're in flight in the game, you're hearing just one woodwind instrument and a couple of pads. Then on the other end of the scale, when it gets to boss fight music, the intensity level is at 10. One other thing about the explore music, which I think is, it's not unique, but it's an interactive bit of execution that I think we did pretty well. So I mentioned each suite has its own style of music, but within that, the music changes based on whether you're walking, riding a horse, flying, or in combat. It's all based on the same piece of music.
Oh, wow.
So though that walking, horse riding, flying, and combat is all part of one suite, which kind of can change on the fly. And each region has three explore suites. So that's three core tracks with four different layers between them. I remember when they first told me that they wanted to implement this system, like, you're crazy, this is never going to work. And they were like, yeah, it is, because you're going to figure it out. And I'm like, great.
Because it's your problem, so it's going
to
be great.
Yes, it is. It is my problem, yes. And it took me a while to settle on it and just try and figure out what I wanted to do. But I think once I figured out that I wanted to make flying the lightest element, everything else kind of fell into place. So the flying is usually just an oboe or an English horn, much more traditional classical sounding instrument, just something light and airy with a ton of reverb on it. And then just a pad in the background, because flying is very serene in the game. And you get that like big top down view where you can really see like almost the entire game area, basically, if you get really high.
Beautiful.
And because of how the game looks, it's really quite fun to look at. Then when you change to horse riding, that's the explore track, which has the most momentum in it because it's the fastest way to get around the map. Was just careful to not have too many percussive elements in it. There are percussive elements in it, but they're really light. It's usually just like a hand drum because really you're hearing like the horse galloping most of the time.
Yeah.
And then there's the walking around music, which is, you know, fairly standard. And because it's walking around, it's a chance to establish melody. Usually the melody that's in the walking around music is the same melody that plays during the flight, but they're never played in the same instrument because the flight music is only ever using a woodwind instrument to play the melody. So when you're walking around, I get to use the melody in literally any other instrument, whether it's a plucked instrument or strings or whatever. So that gives me a bit more flexibility with walking around because the player is going to spend the most time walking or running in the game because flying takes up stamina. So you can't fly forever. And the same with horse riding. The horse riding also has a stamina bar. So we had to make sure that the basic walking music sounds like the most interesting to listen to. And then last of all is the combat music. And because I hadn't really used any orchestra in the horse riding, explore, or ambient music, it left me like that whole texture to use for the combat music and also heavier percussion. So the one thing I normally do when I'm doing combat music is I keep it fairly light on the percussion. But with this game, because of the tone and how like over the top everything is, they were like, look, just go for it and we'll figure it out in the mix later. I'm like, really? Are you sure? Because me going for it can get pretty loud. and they were like, yes, no problem. Don't worry about it. It's, you know, it's such an over the top game that you can kind of get away with it. And actually, it's funny because even though I thought I went heavy, there's percussion that's transient heavy where you really hear like every smash. But then there's percussion where you can like bury it way back in the mix and you still kind of feel it, but it doesn't sound like it's right next to your face.
Yeah.
And that kind of helped it work with the sound effects a little bit better, which obviously do sound like they're right next to your face because they're recorded very dry. And so we ended up having a pretty nice blend of like heavy orchestral music for the combat, blending with the sound effects of the game. And so, yeah, that kind of gives you a little bit of insight. Is one of the reasons why the soundtrack is so long is because we actually did the audio director was like, let's put everything on the soundtrack. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a lot of music because these suites are like explore, horse, flying, and combat. And so we did like edits of all of that within a track on the soundtrack. And then there's all the boss fight music, and then there's cutscene music, and then there's the dungeons music, which we call in the game the Tartarus Vaults, which are like super ambient and weird. And that's how you end up with a soundtrack that on the original game is 3.5 hours long.
Man, and that's just a brief insight. I love the creative process behind all of this and all of the thought process with the different gods and the different traversal styles and the combat and everything. When you explain it, you're like, oh yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, woodwind for flying and lighter and, you know, the kind of different areas and things.
I think the best implementation actually is the stuff that you only realize, oh yeah, well, it's obvious that you would have done that. And you would feel it if it wasn't there. I feel that implementation that draws attention to itself, it works in some games. An example of a game where it works really well is Sackboy. It's because the gameplay and the visuals of that game support it. But if you have the implementation drawing too much attention to itself in a game like this, where we're trying to just immerse the player in the big picture, as opposed to like specific actions, Sackboy, a lot of the music changes are very tied to very specific actions in the game. This, it might sound like, oh, you're flying and the music changes, but actually the change is very organic. It's not like it changes instantly, because that would feel gimmicky. Yeah. The thing that I think really helped is that we were able to figure out the first suite of music with those four different gameplay elements really early on in the process. And so that allowed them to tweak the magic algorithm to make sure that it wasn't too sensitive, or is finding that balance where it changes just often enough to make the music feel like it's developing with what the player is doing. But if it changed too often, you can switch from flying to walking to horse riding, you know, three times in a second. Well, that's obviously not going to work. If you know you're doing that with music, it's just going to suck.
It becomes too gamey, for want of a better word.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's one of those things you try to get it changing as organically as possible. And once we finished the first suite, Ubisoft's wonderful programming teams kind of just took my different elements, and then they were able to experiment with it to like figure out a flow that would work well, and they'd send me back gameplay footage with you know, how that was working in game, and to see if I had any feedback as well. It was really nice to have quite a high degree of input in terms of like how the music is working in the game, and you know, does everything change properly, and is it musically satisfying, and all of that. Because that's not necessarily always the case. Sometimes you can end up, you know, just give us hours and hours of music, and then we'll get it in the game.
yeah, we'll figure it out. Don't worry about how it's used. You don't need to know.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it was kind of nice to have a little bit of ownership on that part of the music development side of things.
Yeah, and I have to say, that's obviously one area where you flourish in your history of games, in terms of like Ori, for example. You had a big hand in how it was used, and you had a lot of freedom there as well. And that really kind of gave you your chance to shine with that soundtrack, and it paid off.
It's something I feel really strongly about now. And I'm now honestly more inclined to choose projects where I am able to have that creative agency over how the music is used. Don't get me wrong, I think there are some composers who would absolutely love nothing to do with that whatsoever. Everyone kind of has their own process, but I just feel like I write better music when I know exactly what the player is going to be doing. When I can feel the game and touch the game, I genuinely feel that I write better music for the game. And I've come to learn that, I hate to say this now, but I'm basically a veteran at this point, because I've survived almost a decade. it's just a style of working that I find suits me. But, you know, there are some people who are like, they don't want a part in that process, but that's why you have these big music teams who can take a composer's great music and then get it in the game by editing it, or, you know, cutting up and doing it that way. But there's lots of different ways to score a game, and many of them are effective, because it's kind of proven by a lot of the great soundtracks that we're getting in games currently. For me, I find that the earlier I can get on a game and help work with the music team or the audio team to, you know, figure out what the game's musical needs are, by the time I get to the end, I can write so insanely fast, because I know the game inside out and I know exactly what the game needs to get over the finish line. And that's a pretty cool feeling, as opposed to if I'm coming on later in development on another project. Like, yeah, I can still get the job done, but I'm relying much more on guidance from an audio director or a music supervisor on what exactly to do, rather than my own intuition. And for some people, they'll definitely prefer getting that explicit direction. But for me, if I have that, I'm definitely 100% sure now that I write better music when I've kind of discovered what my own intuition is for a scene. And then I talk about it with the development team and we see if we're on the same page. And sometimes we're not. And then you end up having a discussion about it. And then you might end up finding a new solution that neither side had even thought of before. And that can end up being really cool.
Yeah. And I'm curious to what level you get stuck in. Like, do you actually have access to middleware and you kind of implement as well? Or do you have a really big conversation with the audio designers or the technical audio designers about how the music system is going to work and what kind of deliverables there are? To what level do you kind of dive in?
This is where I've had a few exchanges on Twitter with other composers who are very passionate about the stuff, most notably Olivier Derivier, who's like probably the implementation god of music composers.
Oh, yeah.
He has a workflow that is really suited for him. And, you know, he believes that every composer should know Wise, at least in some level. And I've been pretty vocal publicly about having no real interest in spending time in Wise. Now, this is the part where it gets interesting, because people can take that to mean as I have no interest in implementation, which, if you're familiar with my work, is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
So what I like to describe it as is I am not a builder. If we're talking in audio implementation terms, a builder is someone who will go in and write the code and hook it up in game. What I am is an architect. The way I worked on Ori, for example, is I recorded video of an entire gameplay section, and it's myself playing the game because I'm obviously familiar with the game. And then I overlay all of the different musical elements that I want to play, whether it's intros, outros, stingers, tracks that play once, tracks that loop. I put that all under the gameplay. I caption the video with exactly what track is playing. And then I accompany that with a PDF explaining all of the different like musical choices that I want. And then on Ori, I handed that off to implementation god Guy Whitmore, who's most famously known for doing the music for Peggle. He's amazing at audio implementation. And he would implement it based on my design that was expressed in the video and the document that I wrote up. So when you hear it like that, it's pretty clear that I have quite a heavy say in the implementation, but just because I'm not like doing the actual code, does it mean I'm not implementing? I don't think so. I have to be honest, I don't think many composers are getting hired because of their incredible coding and setup skills in Wise. We are hired to write music first, but I think we're also hired for the creative choices we make in implementation. There's the coding and the technical side to implementation. And I think if you have knowledge of that, this is probably what Olivier is getting at. I think if you have knowledge of that, then the potential at what you could possibly do with your music inside Wise is maybe limitless. And so he definitely has a point there. But for me, there is a creative side to implementing. And it really comes down to spotting, actually. Like, my big thing is the right music playing at the right time, because it's especially a problem in big open world games, is that quite often the wrong music plays because it's defined by a system. And in an ideal world, you need a balance between something that is set up by a system, but then you also need things that are hand placed. And the reason why Ori feels the way it does, listen, all of Ori's music is loop-based. There's no vertical interactivity whatsoever. But the reason it works is I spent so many hours trying to figure out where the exact best placement was of where music should change within each environment and within each like storytelling moment. And that's really just the equivalent of spotting for film and television. It's a little bit different for games because you've got to take into account so many different parameters. But good spotting in games is not easy to find, but you know when it's been done well. And that is the creative aspects of implementation, because you can hand off your music to an implementation team and you're not going to know how your music's going to play back in game. And that just makes me uncomfortable as a composer. Like, I want to know when and where exactly every single cue I wrote played back in the game. That's something that's really, really important to me. And so I try to spend as much time as possible on that, because I think the end result is felt by the player.
Yeah, and you're quite a passionate gamer yourself as well, which probably plays into this, right?
Yes, exactly. I'll play whatever is nominated for audio at the BAFTAs, because it's a good place to start, I think. You know, I generally pay attention to, you know, the sound of music and how it's behaving in the game. And also as a gamer, I have my own taste as to things that I like. And, you know, I've played a lot of games, so I feel like my taste is reasonably well developed. And that gives me a lot of context for how I want the music to play back, because I've experienced a lot of games that have done it well, and I've experienced games that have done it not so well. All of that has informed like my choices of where I place music in a game such as Ori.
It depends what the project needs, as is the nature of the beast, right? So depending what kind of score you need or what kind of skill level in certain areas you need, you will maybe go to different composers because you want a tech heavy soundtrack and you want the composer to have a hand in that. Or maybe you have a big audio team or technical audio team that's handling that, and you just need to converse that to the composer and get what you need into the system.
You're absolutely right. Like, certain composers do bring certain skills to the table. And something that I've been saying a bit recently, I'm like, my approach to writing video games will cause me to not get hired on certain games. And I'm 100% okay with that.
Yeah.
Because my approach will also pretty much guarantee me to get me at least in a conversation somewhere, like for a game that kind of wants my holistic style of, you know, being quite hands-on, not on the tech side of things, but so on the creative side of, like, you know, how music plays back in the game, and also getting that kind of synergy between the music and the environment. And you've kind of touched on that. I think you're going to see that a lot more in the coming generation. It's some scores do require a tech heavy approach, and some require none at all. Some require, you know, just very simple rudimentary playback. And then it's really about, like, we need a composer to absolutely nail the right mood for this game. And there are some composers who are absolute experts at, like, nailing a mood for a game. Good point that you made.
And yeah, no, I fully agree. And I think some of the time, and composers are too, especially fairly new composers or people wanting to get into composition, they're so eager to be a one size fits all that they try to learn everything and be good at everything. And then there's that danger that people don't know what to come to you for, because they're like, okay, so what is your thing? And you're like, oh, well, I do everything. And you're like, well, okay, so what does that mean? whereas if you take a firm stance, which I think you have to agree comes with the experience, and once you're maybe a bit later in your career,
yes,
where you can be like, okay, I found what I'm good at. I know what I'm good at.
I didn't know my best way of working until I finished Ori and the Blind Forest back in 2014.
Man, was it that long ago already?
Yes. And I was like, you know, this is the way I like to work. Like, I like to be hands-on. And it's not just me that's saying this, but I'm like, get your composer on early, even in pre-production if you have to. Of course, a lot of developers don't want to do that because, you know, composers cost money. And they're like, well, why can't we just bring the composer on the end and save some money? But I think, especially in the last few years, you've seen the results of composers that have been attached to projects for a long time. And the music, it fits the respective games like a glove. We've got a game coming out next year that is probably going to have one of the best soundtracks of the year. It's the next game in the Horizon Zero Dawn series. And, you know, Joris de Man is at one with Guerrilla Games. He's like the man. That's a terrible pun because his last name is Demand. Oh, wow, Demand. That's bad. Anyway.
It's going to be public now. You know that, right?
Yes, that's fine. but he's worked with them for so long, and the game's music really fits like a glove. We saw the same thing with The Witcher 3.
Yeah.
These composers have been attached to the project for a long time, but it doesn't actually happen that often in AAA. I feel like it should happen more, especially with the scale of the games that are being made now, because it truly can be felt in the end product. And I've been brought on, I cannot say what it is, but I've been brought onto a project that has me on in pre-production, which is just frankly incredible. And I get to experiment, I get to fail, I get to try things out that I would never have dreamt of trying before. Get to work with the audio director and figure out combat systems, the music systems in the game. How much music do we want in the game? Where might music want to play? And it's all experimental at the moment, and nothing's off the table. At some point in the pretty distant future, we'll get to near the end of the project, and we'll know exactly what to do because of all of this work that's being done now. That's just a kind of a nice place to be in. So I hope that the industry in general moves towards that direction a little bit more, because it is felt in the end product, I think.
Yeah, and there's the old cliche, even for the audio side of things, that, you know, things are a bit late coming to our side.
Yeah.
And the earlier we're brought on, the better.
Exactly.
As part of the team. And, you know, someone like Darren Korb, for example, who's doing all of it and he's there from day one, you can tell in the soundtrack and in the sound design even.
That's another perfect example. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Darren's work at Supergiant, he is the audio at Supergiant. So, yeah, and it's felt. And those games all have a unique identity. And surprise, surprise, it's because the guy's been there since the beginning of each project. So it's not really a surprise. The only surprise is really that he keeps on managing to reinvent himself for every project. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I have to say the soundtracks are incredible and the sound design have just been top notch. I do kind of want to touch on something I said earlier and sort of discuss this with you, because yes, I was saying that maybe you shouldn't try and do everything all the time, but the whole point is that you do at first, right? To find out what you're good at and what you do.
Yeah.
Now, finding that balance, when did you get to a point where you felt strong enough in your convictions for certain skills and not others, where you're like, okay, this is somewhere where A, I know I can shine, and B, I'm going to develop these skills, as opposed to the other side of the coin where you're like, do you know what? I did my best, but that's not where I'm going to be the best. So I'm going to leave that kind of alone.
I think honestly, it became after RE1 got wrapped. I was like, okay, well, I finished the soundtrack, but I still kind of don't really know what I'm doing. I would honestly say after doing Arc 1 and recording it, I was like, okay, I've done this process now, and this is like up to the highest level. You know, there's not going to be too many opportunities to record with a 93-piece orchestra again. So I had a full understanding of the process, how to get 2 hours of music done and orchestrated and recorded and then put in the game, et cetera, et cetera. And that was after a couple of years of doing different things for Minecraft as well. It wasn't really that initial project with Ori that gave me the idea of how I want to work. It kind of, I was very lucky that a lot of opportunities came to me because of Ori, notably Minecraft, obviously. And I got a lot of chances to kind of perfect and hone not just my craft, but also my way of working, so I could figure out what was my most effective way of working. Probably about the time I started working fully on Ori 2, actually. And so you kind of learn what to let go of. One of the hardest things for me to let go of, actually, was orchestration. But it's like, it's physically impossible to orchestrate 3 hours of recorded music, especially when it's all being written in like the last 2 to 3 months. Like to get all of that notation ready, for example, it's when you're also worrying about how it's going to play back in the game. And you're also trying to worry about when you're going to get it mixed. And then you've got to worry about the stems that you got to deliver. There's just so many things that are going on. It's like, okay, well, look, I can not worry about this. Because here's the thing. On Ori 1, I literally did everything. Right down to the printing of the music, which is absolutely insane.
That's a lot.
And very stupid. Yeah. So like composition, orchestration, even prepping the Pro Tools sessions for recording. Like I did it all. And I'm not saying I'm amazing, because I'm sure there's other composers that did that too, but that was my first project. And if ever there was a project to be delegating on, it would be that one. But I was kind of just winging it, really. But because I'd been through that process, I, moving forward, I kind of knew what I could drop and the and I wouldn't lose that much from my own identity in the work. Because just as an example, orchestration in Ori 2 didn't really change that much from Ori 1, other than we had a bigger orchestra. But like stylistically, the style was set. So it's actually pretty easy to bring a couple of other people on and have them follow in the style of the first game. It's the same with Arc. You know, we just did Arc Genesis 2 and we did that at Abbey Road again.
Lovely.
And I'm like, well, look, here's 2 hours of music from the original version of this game. And I was like, look, basically Genesis 2 has the Arc orchestral DNA, but we've got a ton of synths. That's basically the difference. And I was like, let's just make sure the orchestra sounds as good and we'll worry about the mixing in post-production, which is how it ended up working out. We did indeed worry about how things balanced in post-production and ended up sounding pretty full and great. But again, I did not do the orchestration on Arc Genesis 2 because it was stylistically kind of set in place. Now, when I'm starting a project from scratch, the pre-production on this new project, I have time to figure out the orchestration. Like, I have time to establish the DNA. If you look through my history of work, the establishment of a musical DNA is kind of my thing. Ori, Arc, Immortals Phoenix Rising, even Darksiders Genesis, which technically is the fourth game in a series, but really it was kind of a spin-off. It was kind of a make your own musical DNA.
Yeah,
I think I'm at my best when I can start from scratch. It's certainly what I enjoy doing the most. It's not that I don't enjoy working on stuff that's already existing, but I feel like because of the way I work, like getting in on a project early, it really benefits that project if it's a new intellectual property because it suits my workflow. I guess what I'm trying to say is I enjoy trying to create franchises.
I was going to say, new IP seems to be coming your thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, Ori turned out pretty good. Arc turned out better than anyone could have imagined, I think. And we'll see if Ubisoft makes a second Immortals game. New IP is great fun to me. It's also just really hard to do. I kind of like the unique challenge. I'm not sure if I've answered your question. I kind of went off on a tangent there, but
you have, and beyond, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But you also brought up Arc, which I was going to bring up next. Speaking of new IPs, it's no longer going to be a new IP because you're currently scoring Arc 2 and Arc the Animated Series. How incredible is that? Considering when Arc Survival Evolved first came out, I don't think any of us expected where it would go next.
You know, it's no secret that Arc on its early access release was, full of bugs and a bit of a janky game. I'm not going to get fired for saying that because there's plenty of evidence online. But the thing is, despite all that, they have an incredible community that still plays the game almost religiously to this day. It's constantly in the top 20 on Steam, usually in the top 10. It's ridiculously popular on console. They've got crossplay. They've got so many different things. And with all of these expansion packs, they've been able to keep it fairly fresh by releasing all of this new content. And Arc Genesis 2 was the fifth and final expansion pack for the first game. And Arc 2 is now in the pipeline. And I have already started work on Arc the Animated Series. I remember when they first started talking about the animated series, and I was like, yeah, whatever, I'll believe it when I see it. And then in my inbox one day comes the trailer for Arc the Animated Series, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, maybe this thing really is happening. And they're like, yeah, we're going to show the trailer at the Game Awards. The Game Awards is watched by zillions of people at this point.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, I guess we better not mess it up. I guess we better do this properly. We actually recorded the trailer music for the animated series also in London. We literally had a recording session just for the trailer.
Amazing.
Yeah, which was awesome. I remember when they first told me the cast list, which if you've seen the cast list, it's bananas.
It's gone from I'll believe it when I see it to, oh, by the way, we've got Vin Diesel, Gerard Butler, Malcolm McDowell, David Tennant,
Russell Crowe, Michelle Yeoh. It's endless. And then the trailer comes in. I'm like, okay, well, that is Russell Crowe doing the narration. And I'm like, so I guess this is real now. And better not mess around and do a really good job on this. And all I can say about the animated series is, for those people who have played Arc, they'll already know this, but Arc actually has a really incredible story. I'm not going to say it's a drawback, but the one maybe difficulty with the game is it requires a lot of hours spent in the game to get the full story. Now, those people who have put those hundreds, sometimes thousands of hours into the game really have an in-depth knowledge of Arc's lore. But what I'm excited about is the TV series is going to bring that lore to life in a more accessible way for people who aren't necessarily gamers or who don't have the time to invest into playing Arc. And the story is really good. When the story is good, it makes the composer's life so much easier. When I start a new episode, I'm just like, man, this is a really cool story. And it just it works a standalone episode, but I also can see how it plays into the overall season and how it plays out. So I definitely didn't see it coming. There were a lot of things with Arc that I never saw coming. First of all, I was like, oh, it's an early access title and most early access titles fail. right? That's just how things go. So that's the first thing. It lasted longer than early access. Then the second thing that happened was like, oh, it went from being an early access title with digital mockups and a handful of tracks to having 2 hours of music recorded at Abbey Road with a 93-piece orchestra. Okay, that's awesome. And then it went from having, you know, just the base game to having 5 expansion packs. And then it was a sequel. And then it was the TV series. And it's like, and now we're basically doing pretty much everything recorded live, which obviously for a composer is awesome. But also Ark justifies it because you've seen the game. It's massive creatures doing epic stuff. And we kind of need the big orchestral forces. I can say this, but for Ark 2, we recorded the main theme and a couple of other tracks for the game. And we also recorded the trailer for Ark 2. The Ark 2 trailer also aired at the Game Awards. And the brass section for that was bigger than what we had for Ark 1. It was 24 brass, which was pretty awesome.
That's some big brass right there.
We had 4 trumpets, 8 horns, 8 trombones, 2 tubas, and 2 cimbassos.
Man, you went all in.
Yep. And maybe we'll increase it some more. I don't know. I don't think we need to. It's kind of pointless once you get beyond a certain size. We would increase it only because we can, not because we should. But yeah, it's just pretty awesome hearing that really rich sound, and it's very fitting for the game. And it's also nice knowing that I have that available to me for every single cue, which is not something that I had on the first game. On the first game, I just assumed that we'd never be recording live because I was like, well, it's an early access title. And, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit successful. We might be able to do the main theme live or something. Of course, it ended up being wildly successful. I believe the game has sold 60 million units. That's 60.
Man, that's crazy. And when did it come out originally?
2015 was early access, and 2017 was the official version 1 release.
Right. And there's still so many people playing it as well.
Yes. Yeah. That's the thing. It's lasted a long time. Bark's done a really great job of keeping the content going and keeping the community alive and fresh. And just as a composer, the creative canvas on which I get to work on, because initially you look and it's like, oh, it's prehistoric and dinosaurs, but once you understand the lore of the game and you understand why the sci-fi element is there, and as a composer, it's like, wow, we're adding the sci-fi element into this game with dinosaurs and all of these really interesting, in the game, they're peripheral characters, but in the animated series, they become, the characters are much more fleshed out. One of the great things about the animated series is I've been able to go back and bring back to life original themes from the very earliest versions of Ark and kind of give them a new lease of life. I don't mean to sound big-headed, but I don't think anyone could score Ark, the animated series, the way I'm doing, because I helped create the musical DNA of the franchise, but I also...
It's kind of like you grew up with the game, right?
Exactly. So I'm going to know like how everything connects. And so the music will work and the show will work for newcomers to it, but for any of the people who have played the game from the outset, there's going to be a lot of nice musical Easter eggs for them in the soundtrack. Yep.
Right, awesome. And Ark 2, does that have a release date yet?
Nope. I think it'll be a case of it'll be ready when it's ready.
Yeah, that's fair. And I have to say that, you know, when you get to this point in your career, which I think we can both agree is fairly successful at this point.
Thank you.
As a composer, when you get to this level from your journey in the beginning of composition to where you are now, what do you start thinking about the future? Like, for example, do you have a dream project you'd love to work on? Do you start thinking of something really specific where you're like, man, I'd really love to sink my teeth into that? Or do you still just go from project to project because you have to?
After Ori and the Will of the Wisps came out, I would say that was the end of Act One of my career. And now I'm in the very, very, very fortunate position. I get a lot of interesting things come in my inbox, and I want to be able to work on things that, you know, interest me creatively, but also fit with exactly how I want to work. And I've kind of already implied that, you know, with that project that I'm working on in pre-production, I mean, that to me it's the dream project. It's a massive, massive world that I'm getting to create from the ground up, like the musical DNA. It's literally a dream. I still can't quite believe they brought me on that early. It's that kind of thing that I really get to sink in my teeth into, because I know I'll be on it for a long time. And you know, so it will be a while before the results come to fruition, but every so often there'll be a project that comes along where it might be like a quicker turnaround, where it's like 6 months to a year or something like that. And, you know, it's just like, hey, can you come and write a couple of hours of music? And if the, you know, if the topic is really interesting, then I'll definitely consider it. But I'm now at the point where I want to do projects where I feel like I can really make a big difference to the emotional experience of the player, rather than just being a music supplier, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from.
I'm in the fortunate position that I've had, you know, lots of interesting requests. And so I'm like, will this project give me a decent amount of creative freedom? Second of all, is it a new IP? Because that's one thing I love. And third of all, will I be able to work closely with the audio team, or is it just something where they're going to be like, we need X amount of tracks by Y date? In terms of genre, the one thing that I think is completely missing from my resume is a science fiction game. That is the one genre I feel like I would love to tackle. And Arc Genesis 2 kind of touches on the science fiction element in the music. It's very synth heavy. It's probably my most synth heavy soundtrack, but I would really like the opportunity to something that's, you know, strictly narrative and not sandbox based. But like I said, I'm not struggling for work at the moment. I'm quite happy. You know, if the sci-fi thing never comes, then that's fine. Obviously I am doing Halo, but because it's not a new IP, it doesn't count in terms of like my criteria. So it's like
the Halo new doesn't count.
Science fiction IP. Like, but it's just different. Like, you know, let's say I worked on Star Wars, because Halo's music is of Star Wars-esque levels in terms of how iconic it is. Mm. It's not something that you can reinvent too much. So I'd like to do a sci-fi where I get the opportunity to do what Marty and Michael did on Halo 1. That's what I'm trying to say. There we go.
Right, yeah.
I think I saved myself there. That was a good save.
Yeah, it was a good one. I think that'll work, yeah.
Right.
So, sadly, I'm drawing to my final question, and I have to admit, I could chat all day.
It's all good.
I've probably asked you this before already, but I'm curious how these sort of answers develop. Where you are now, if you could give advice to your past self, what would it be?
It's going to be funny if I give the same answer that I gave to you the last time I was on it. But I think I've already addressed this one thing. It's the don't be afraid to delegate, because it's not worth being prideful over like, you know, oh, I must do everything myself. No, life's too short. And if you hire the right people, you can actually often end up getting a better result, because one, you're not tired from being overworked. But two, you know, there are actually quite often other people who are much better at the same job than you are. And your job as a composer is to ultimately deliver music in a finished format. That doesn't necessarily mean you must compose, orchestrate, print all the music, do all of the other stuff that is very important to the process. But ultimately, the end goal is to deliver music in a finished form. And so you have to do whatever it takes to do that to the highest level. And, you know, me of 5 years ago would have been like, no, I must do everything myself. I mean, I orchestrated all of the Ark soundtrack myself, the original recording, like what, well, you were there at Abbey Road. And yeah, so
yeah,
that was my orchestration. And I did that. That was kind of like the last time I really like fully orchestrated a project from start to finish. But I did that to kind of prove to myself that I could do it for 93 players, because it's probably not going to get much bigger than that in one's career. And I was like, all right, I have nothing left to prove to myself. I can do it, which now means I can assign it to someone else and know exactly what to expect from them, no matter what in the future.
Yeah.
That's basically my one rule with delegation. I have to have done it myself in some shape or form, or at least tried to have done it, so I can like understand it before like assigning it to someone else. That's really like, I think the main thing for me, because I tended 5 years ago to get caught up in trying to do too much myself. But it's funny, I genuinely can't remember what I said in my answer to that question, because I do remember you asked that question the last time. So it will be funny to go back and see if it's the same thing.
Yeah, I'm curious as well, because I don't remember either. But I think it's a fantastic note to end on, especially as it ties into what we were saying earlier, especially with your approach, where you learned what you could do.
Yep.
You did it yourself first. Yep. And then went, you know what? I've done it. I can delegate now.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I have to say, it's always a pleasure, Gareth, to have you on the show, and I hope you'll join us again in the near future.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, Sam.
And I, for one, am very excited for Ark the Animated Series, and I look forward to some news on Ark 2, as well as anything else that you got cooking up. I'm really curious about this one that you're on super early in pre-production.
It's going to be a while before that one comes out.
I know, it's going to be like 5 years before I even hear about it, isn't it?
Probably something like that, yeah, but I am pretty confident that it will be worth the wait.
Well, we can look back at this episode in 5 years' time and compare notes, you see.
So. Exactly.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Gareth, and thanks everyone for listening. This is Sam. Thanks very much for listening to the Sound Architect podcast today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, there are many ways you can support the show, which is incredibly appreciated. Obviously, there's the financial way, where you can support us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/sounddesignuk. However, there are many other ways which also help, such as liking, subscribing, reviewing, commenting, and sharing via whatever channel you listen on. Thanks so much for your support already. It really is a work of passion for me, and I'd love to keep sharing the knowledge from all these talented and wonderful people. Thanks again, and catch you on the next episode.